The Tom Woods Show, episode 1823.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here, thinking out loud today about the situation we face. Sure seems pretty darn grim, does it not? And you and I are accustomed to facing more or less impossible odds, but they seem to be like impossible squared right now with the situation before us. And I just want to think a little bit about it, try to clarify it, and figure out what the next steps ought to be. Now, I'm not really a strategist, as you may have figured out. I'm the guy who gives you the raw data or who tells you about the history or gives you the economic analysis, and then you go run with that. You do the strategic work, but you need the raw material. You need the knowledge. That's what I'm here for. I'm not really a strategist because I, frankly, most of the time don't know what to do. I'm not somebody like Michael Bolden, who was a creative genius who devised the ideas behind the 10th Amendment Center. And that really did change things. That really inserted into the conversation the idea that you could actually resist federal government overreach. And he's accomplished that in state after state, on issue after issue. And he did that by means of the infrastructure he created with the 10th Amendment Center. Now, I have not done anything like that, but I am, I think, nevertheless, doing something of value, which is to help people see clearly what's happening and to understand what's going on and to be equipped with the knowledge that they need. And they need that knowledge not just to win debates with people, because these days, you know, they say we're living in post-persuasion America. Maybe your arguments don't even matter all that much. But frankly, to reassure yourself that you're on the right track when you're surrounded by every institution imaginable telling you that not only are you wrong, you're a threat to society. And you need to be encouraged on that. And incidentally, I mentioned this in my newsletter not too long ago. It's great to get email feedback from people who had their, let's say, their worldview changed because they listened to me or they read something I wrote. That's really, really satisfying and makes me happy. And I get that a lot. It surprised me. And it surprised me how many people who were on the left, I'm not even aiming at them really, nevertheless, they just listened in good faith and decided I was right. These things make me very happy. But nevertheless, I do get some people who say I'm just preaching to the choir. You're preaching to the choir, Woods. Well, a couple things. Number one, if I were, I wouldn't be converting all these people. Secondly, I do speak to a variety of audiences. I don't do as much public speaking as I used to. I just don't enjoy it as much as I used to. But I spoke to plenty of left liberal audiences. I mean, I twice spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder. First time I went there, I did not know what its reputation was. I'm just an innocent guy thinking it's just another university. And I managed to get them to sit down and listen to a talk about Austrian business cycle theory. So I was very satisfied with that. But also, I've spoken to a lot of Tea Party groups. Like 10 years ago, I was speaking to a bunch of them, and they were not completely on board with the way I saw the world. But doggone it, I got them to listen, and I got them to consider ideas they hadn't considered before. Nevertheless, I get this, you're preaching to the choir. And I want to reemphasize something I said in my newsletter, which is the choir needs to be preached to. It's wrong to dismiss, to just sniff that you're just preaching to the choir. Well, you know, every choir I've ever seen in a church gets preached to. The pastor doesn't say, all right, I'm about to give my sermon so the choir can go out and have a cigarette. The choir sits there during the sermon because the choir also needs to be preached to. Not only because they need to be fortified with knowledge, but they also need to be fortified with confidence that they're right. And in this world, I can imagine why occasionally we lose a person, because it just seems like too much. All the time being told you're a demon, and all the time being told you're ignorant, that can wear on a person, I'm sure. I mean, not on me. It rolls right off me. I absolutely relish the contempt of these people. But that's just my temperament. Not everyone has that kind of temperament. So I understand why we lose people. I understand that the fight gets to be too great. The burden on your shoulders gets to be too heavy. And so the choir needs to be preached to. We have to at least hold on to what we have now, while at the same time trying to reach others. So what exactly is the division all about? Well, of course, in the newspapers, they want you to think that it's just between red states and blue states. And there's certainly something to that, of course. But I don't think most people really neatly fit into one of those two categories. Maybe some do. But I think there are a lot of hues other than blue and red that describe most people. And the idea that there are only two ways of looking at the world, and one of them's the red state way, one of them's the blue state way, just doesn't satisfy me, because I certainly don't fit into either of those categories. I know which one I'm more sympathetic with because I know which one isn't going to badger me 24 hours a day about conforming, but I'm not fully at home in either one of those. Now, when I try to say that it's a left versus right divide, I get a lot of lecturing from libertarians. Not all, but I get a lot of lecturing. Oh, that's a myth. This left-right paradigm is meaningless. Okay, well, I'm not going to talk too much about it today, but it's not meaningless, and it has tremendous explanatory power. Now, if you're going to say to me that, look, the establishment consists of people like Mitt Romney and Joe Lieberman and Hillary Clinton, and what's really to choose between these people? Of course, I get that. But I don't really think Mitt Romney, by any serious definition, is right wing. So I don't think this is any answer to me. And to say it's not left versus right, it's tyranny versus freedom. Okay, tomato, tomato, I would say. In general, not always, but in general. And the fact is this, I wrote a book called Real Dissent, and the bulk of it is against the neoconservatives. Okay, I was not spending that much time attacking the left in those days. I thought the more urgent thing is to get rid of these neocons. And so I wrote Real Dissent, and I'm very, very pleased with that book. And I'll tell you, Fox News made me crazy, right? Absolutely made me crazy with the propaganda, particularly the war propaganda, and I couldn't denounce it enough. But let's face it, people like me, people more or less in our circle, are vastly more likely to be invited onto Fox News than onto MSNBC. That's just a fact. I'm vastly more likely to be invited to a Tea Party event than to some Green Party event. That's just a fact. You know, you can pretend that there's no significance to that and just continue saying there's no such thing as the left-right divide. Okay, I mean, you could say that, but it just doesn't conform to reality. This, our friend, the economist David R. Henderson, pointed out this obvious point to me, that at least he can get on Fox News, that they're not inviting him on MSNBC. There's got to be a reason for that. But since these sorts of terms annoy some people, I'm going to try to talk about other sources of division that can account for what's going on in the country right now. And one of them is going to refer back to an episode of this show I did with Michael Malice a long time ago. And I'll link to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1823. And it has to do with Thomas Sowell's great book, Conflict of Visions. Now, looking at a title like that and knowing that the author is Thomas Sowell, you might think that the conflict of visions must be between libertarians and statists, something like that. But I mean, Sowell's a little bit more sophisticated than that. And what he's describing in that book is a conflict between two different visions of the world and how it works. One of them is the unconstrained vision. That's what he calls it. And the other one is the constrained vision. Now, you may think I'm caricaturing one side, but I don't think I am. And I'm just trying to get you to understand the way these two different groups, and I do think these are two distinct groups, look at the world and how they think it works. So in the unconstrained vision, there is very little holding us back from accomplishing whatever we want. It's kind of, the unconstrained vision is kind of like what you hear in the typical valedictory address at a high school. You can do anything you set your mind to. Don't give up. Follow your dreams kind of thing, okay? And then everybody else is rolling their eyes through the whole speech, like, oh, kid, can't wait to see you in your 20th high school reunion, how you feel. But I don't mean to be cynical here, but that's the unconstrained vision, that all we need to do is envision a better world, is to come up with something that we desire. And then it's just a matter of the willpower to bring it about. We just have to pass a law. We have to change people's thinking. Like whatever, it's just some obstacle, we could just get rid of it. We could have the world that we want. That's the unconstrained vision. We have boundless possibilities, and we're limited only by our will. So you want X, pass a law requiring X. It also calls to mind, for me at least, thinkers who have thought that what's holding mankind back from creating the ideal society is some institution that has harmed us in some way or holds us in chains. Jean-Jacques Rousseau is an example of this, that it's institutions holding us back. We also saw that in some of the utopian communities of the 19th century in the United States and some of the reform movements in the United States. The thinking always was there's something external to mankind that is restraining it from reaching its full potential. So it could be alcoholic drink. That was one that if we could get rid of that, that would solve our problems. Lack of education. That was another one. Education had kind of messianic promises attached to it. It was Horace Mann, who was a major figure in the public school effort, who said that if we had public schools for everybody, that 90% of the crime would go away. 90% of the crime. So for the temperance people, it was alcohol. For these people, it was ignorance. That was what was holding us back. For some of the utopian communities, it was private property, because private property encourages avarice and competitiveness, and it undermines the natural brotherhood that would otherwise exist. In the community of John Humphrey Noyes, it was monogamous marriage, because that too, like private property, holds people back. And there's rivalry. I have a prettier wife than you, and only I can be intimate with my wife, and this and that. So that is the unconstrained vision. The constrained vision takes rather a more, let's say, tragic view of human nature and its possibilities and limitations. The constrained view realizes that some things are not possible, some things can't be done, and that there are reasons that they can't be done. You can't have socialism in the Marxian sense because of the socialist calculation problem. You can't just wish that away. No amount of willpower, no amount of passing laws can substitute for the fact that if there's no private property in the means of production, therefore there's no exchange going on in the means of production, so therefore there are no prices being determined for the means of production, so therefore there's no way to calculate profit and loss, and therefore to calculate whether you're wasting resources or adding value to them, so there's no way to know whether the various projects that you're engaged in throughout the economy add value or whether they are destructively uneconomic. You have absolutely no way of knowing that. And you can have all the sweet little dreams in your head that you want, but that's not enough to solve these practical problems. But beyond that, of course, the idea of human nature itself, that it will not admit of these kinds of utopian schemes. That for one thing, although a lot of people in general wish the human race well, we have care only for a certain number of people. We can't be equally concerned for somebody 5,000 miles away from us as we are for our own children, and nor would we want that. Also, there is much, much more respect, I think, for diversity among the constrained vision, that not everyone will wind up living the same way or thinking the same way or holding the same values. In general, there are certain values that everybody holds. You won't really find very many societies that celebrate, let's say, murder, outright murder, very few. So there are some things we share in common, but you can understand why somebody who believes in the constrained vision would be less likely to think you can export democracy and feminism to Afghanistan, or that you can export the Enlightenment to some other country, and just in 5 years, they're all going to be John Locke, or they're all going to be Voltaire. That's something the unconstrained vision might think is possible. Or a planned economy. Well, it would be more efficient, they think, wrongly. So again, we just have to put our mind to it, and we'll make that happen. And notice that in Marx's formulation of it, he won't even tell you how that's going to work or what it'll look like. Like it's silly and petty and bourgeois of you even to ask that question. Well, there's the unconstrained vision. They're not even interested in the practical nuts and bolts of something. And of course, we see it in this whole COVID fiasco, the idea that the government's going to suppress this virus. It's got all these tools in its tool chest, and it'll suppress it. And if it hasn't suppressed it, that's just because you stupid people won't follow the science. Okay, whereas the constrained vision is thinking, this sounds a little cartoonish to me, a little bit cartoonish. All right, before I forget, let me interrupt myself here and tell you about a podcast I came across that I think you need to hear. And it's by our friend David Gornosky, who's been a guest on this program. He's been at one of my house events. You're definitely going to like it. It's called A Neighbor's Choice. And it's been called An Apocalyptic Mr. Rogers for Adults. And one of his consistent themes on A Neighbor's Choice is that politics is a scapegoating ritual rooted in human sacrifice. So how's that for getting your attention? He talks to all kinds of people you find interesting, like I do, like Ron Paul, Peter Schiff, and Jeff Dice of the Mises Institute. But he also talks to people on cultural issues like Jordan Peterson, Scott Adams. So it definitely stands out from other libertarian podcasts, but also in another way, the show features call-in interviews with prisoners who are serving life sentences for nonviolent crimes. And so you get a sense of what life is like for those people. And plus, each week, he features solutions from scientists on the cutting edge of market innovations in areas like energy, nutrition, and medicine that involve thinking in fresh and exciting new ways. So from newsmakers to innovators, David brings his neighbors on a mind-blowing journey. So check out the show by subscribing to David Gornosky on Apple Podcasts. Gornosky is Gornoski, just the way it sounds, David Gornosky. Or you can visit his website, aneighborschoice.com. He's on YouTube, youtube.com/David Gornosky, Gornoski. But you can find all these things at the website, aneighborschoice.com. So that's one source of division. Another source is universalist versus particularist. We've heard a lot of our folks say, we need secession. We need to divide because we obviously don't get along. And we're each trying to ram a worldview down the throats of tens of millions of people, each side of this thing. And wouldn't it be better for us to just go our separate ways? And there are some people on both sides of this divide who would see the sense in that. The very same people who would tell individuals, don't stay in an abusive relationship, I think would have a hard time making a really persuasive case that you should stay in an abusive political relationship. Why wouldn't you stick to your principles throughout? In all kinds of relationships, say abusiveness should be avoided and you should separate. You know, it doesn't make sense that you would make an exception for the one. So you do find some people on both sides. But in general, the problem that I see is the problem that's gone back in time to leftist revolutionary movements, at least to the French Revolution, which is that these visions are universalist. That is to say, they don't think, well, we're going to live according to the Enlightenment, and those people over there are going to live in their own backward way. And, you know, let the best society win, and we wish them the best, and we hope. No, that is not the way they think. That is not the way they operate. You don't have a right to exist. Your society doesn't have a right to exist. So we're going to go in there and change it. We're going to make it the way it needs to be. So the idea that you're just going to be allowed to split apart and live the way you want to does not enter into this calculus. We're going to come in there and overturn all the oppressions that we think you're engaged in. And that is certainly the way the French revolutionaries behaved, and it's certainly the way the communists behaved. They didn't say, well, maybe there's some part of society, some part of this territory that doesn't want to be communist, so we'll let them live their way, and then we'll live ours. Did that ever happen? Now, it's also true that you have nationalists on the right. Now, they may not be as universalist because they don't necessarily want to spread their ideas to the far corners of the world, but still they won't allow internal separation because they think of the nation as one and indivisible, which is one of the most destructive ideas of the 20th century, is that these giant megastates are one and indivisible, whereas the principle of divisibility is what has prevented a lot of conflict in the past, what can prevent conflict. And it was a great step forward for civilization when the Soviet Union split into its constituent parts, you know, peacefully. That was a good thing. These huge megastates from which exit is impossible also unleashed on the world the horrors of total war and totalitarian revolutions. These are not things to celebrate. So indeed, you can find, if not universalism, then at least nevertheless, within a country, the idea that we can't have constituent parts that have liberties of their own, that have any sort of independence from the center. You definitely see that in nationalistic movements. But what you also have very much present within the conservative mindset is the idea that you should be focused on hearth and home. You should be focused on a series of concentric circles. Cicero was talking about this when he said, "The union and fellowship of men will be best preserved if each receives from us the more kindness in proportion as he is more closely connected with us." And then in 1 Timothy, St. Paul says, "If any man have not care of his own, and especially of those of his house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." That's the way the conservative mindset thinks. That's why they're not generally consumed with, I have to work in the federal education bureaucracy. They'd rather say, well, I better improve the education of my own kids and maybe in this neighborhood here. That's where my responsibility, according to my state in life, lies. Whereas Rousseau, well, he's all tears and pity about earthquake victims in Lisbon, but he abandoned five of his own children, who actually are his responsibility, to the Paris Foundling Hospital. So this idea is that you incur certain natural responsibilities according to being a father, a husband, a friend, responsibilities to specific people and specific places, not a general universalist, ceaseless crusade across the entire world. And so if you're wondering why it seems like, yes, I'm going to use the term the left because it describes a distinct group of people who hold the ideologies I've just described to you, if it seems like they're much more vicious against their enemies, they're going to track them, they're going to re-educate them, all this stuff, that's because it's the way they think, that they have the correct worldview, which everybody thinks he has the correct worldview, but they have to enforce it everywhere to the extent that they can. They've got to spread it. And you don't have a right to exist. It's not a matter of, well, let's agree to disagree. You really don't have a right to exist. So the important thing for us to think about then is, how do you handle this kind of situation? Is it just you keep on voting? Well, I mean, maybe in some cases, voting could have the effect of delaying the conflict. I don't mean it's going to be a violent conflict or a military conflict, but there's certainly an ideological conflict that's very much brewing right now. So what can we do about this? And we do have to talk about secession. We have to raise these ideas. Very disappointing that apparently Tucker Carlson just dismissed all this. I wonder if that's an indication that he has political ambitions, so he doesn't want to be on the record on that. I don't know. But we have to get people able to think of things they hadn't thought of before, because the things they've tried just aren't working. They're not working. And I think this is one thing that the left has been very good at, is that, like, for example, in 1980, literally nobody was thinking about gay marriage. Absolutely not one person. And now, if you're against gay marriage, you're going to lose your job. You're just persecuted and driven out of society. So you see, they're good at this. They take something that was on literally nobody's radar and they get everybody talking about it. Now, of course, they have allies we don't have. They have the mass media and so on and so forth. But we have a major chunk of the country that does not trust the media. So we don't necessarily have to assume that all is lost because we don't have the media in our corner. I would love to see us have major victories in the United States, and certainly a lot of local victories at the state and local level, and the 10th Amendment Center will certainly help with that. But we've got to make sure we keep our eye on the ball. The people who are closest to us, we're responsible for, we've got to keep an eye on them. Because if you spend your life trying to spread human rights to Saudi Arabia, but in the meantime you lose your own children to this awful ideology, you will have to deal with the fruits of overturning the natural order of the duties you owe. I wrote in my newsletter, how do you hold on to what is good at a time when so many people around you and every institution, including those you value and wish you could still respect, have gone over to evil? Well, I quote Christopher Dawson, who taught at Harvard in the early 20th century, like in the 1930s. He was talking about after the Carolingian Empire declined. He says it was the great monasteries that were the only remaining islands of intellectual life amidst the returning flood of barbarism, which once again threatened to submerge Western Christendom. For though monasticism seems at first sight ill-adapted to withstand the material destructiveness of an age of lawlessness and war, it was an institution which possessed extraordinary recuperative power. And another historian said this, 99 out of 100 monasteries could be burnt and the monks killed or driven out, and yet the whole tradition could be reconstituted from the one survivor. Now, these passages that I've just read to you are not intended to be applied literally in 2021. It's not monasteries that are going to be the centers of civilization. It's the household. It's the household that takes the place of the monastery in this tale. So instead of a network of monasteries holding fast to tradition until a more civilized world is ready to hear it again, it's up to us in our homes and in our families to teach and hand down those things that are beautiful and wise and good, to make contact with others who are doing the same, and to prepare the soil for better times to come. Now, I am not counseling defeatism or retreatism. I keep on fighting for what is good and right as loudly and publicly as I can. But my primary obligations are the ones I've incurred as a father, friend, and colleague. And my goals are sensible and finite, not open-ended and universal. And the way I put it in my newsletter was, if people want to live like damn fools in San Francisco, that's their concern, not mine. We have many things working in our favor. We are still better off in some ways than we were in the past, and we have more opportunities to reach people than we did in the past, and we can't forget that. But a lot of what we've done has not been working, and we have to rethink it, and we have to talk about different approaches. We have to start debating and at least raising the issue of downsizing, decentralization, smaller units, so that, yeah, you won't like every single place in the U.S. any more than you do right now, but there'll be somewhere where you'll fit right in. I happen to have a little group of rebuilders. They're called the Tom Woods Show Elite, and I would love for you to join them. It is one of the perks of being a supporting listener of the Tom Woods Show. It's a great, great bunch of people, very smart, sharp. They'll keep you informed, congenial. You'll very much enjoy being part of that group. And I have a number of unannounced bonuses I give to folks who are in it, including occasional events at my own home. And also, as I said, at my 2000th episode, you get a dinner with me. It's going to be a lot of people there. But if you're a supporter of the show, you get that. And you know, I do various things for you guys because I really appreciate what you're doing. And you get a lot, just a crazy number of benefits for supporting the Tom Woods Show. This ain't no PBS umbrella. You get a lot of great things. So join our little band of rebuilders. Head over to supportinglisteners.com if you like and appreciate what I'm doing here. And I'll see you all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.